Thanks, Tanya. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. It's great to be a host for this session. My name is Rahul. I'm a proud C&L member at ODF since last 4 years. Giuseppe is a management consultant and leadership coach. For over 25 years, she has worked with global companies and multiple industries, building integrated strategic change capabilities. Giuseppe holds a JD from Universidad del Rosario, an LLM in financial law, and an MA in organization development and change leadership from University of St. Thomas. Julia is the founder of Star Pattern Consulting and an org development leader and practitioner. For over 25 years, she has held global executive and consulting roles in org development and talent management across leading companies in the biopharma, technology, and consumer product industries. Julia holds a BA in communications from Villanova University, an MS in Org Dynamics from the University of Pennsylvania, and she is a global fellow of the Wharton School. Giuseppe and Julia, thank you very much for leading this session, and we look forward to participating and learning from your experience and insights.
Great.
Rahul. Thank you. That lovely introduction. So we'll go ahead and jump right in. We have a couple objectives for you today. We're going to look at organization design with a systems thinking lens. And so we're going to talk about how Giuseppe and I use organization diagnosis to truly look at a systemic view of the organization as we design it. We'll also go beyond the formal organization and look at the informal, the design, the network, the system dynamics. And what's important to us is really paying attention to the other system elements beyond structure when we do org design. So we're going to talk about these three things. And just from a process perspective, we've built in a little bit of space for interaction. So we'd love to hear your thoughts on that. And we'll if you could hold your questions until the end, that we've also reserved some time for that. One note about confidentiality. So we're going to share a couple case studies that are from our real world work with clients over the years. And so to maintain their confidentiality, we've left out identifying details, which are really not relevant anyway to the message that we want to convey with this community. And so we'll share a few graphs and images. They're not exact client data, but they're certainly illustrative to make the point. All right. So we're going to jump right in with a chat poll. If you can put your thoughts together on how would you describe a system? What's one word or one or two words that come to mind when you think about a system? Okay, I'm trying to see my chat. There we go. More than the sum of the parts. How the worlds interact, complexity, interconnected, more interconnected. Lots of interconnected. I love it. Dynamic, social, gunky, awesome. The relationships between things. So yeah, these are great words popping up here. I will share with you, here's one definition. There are several, but here's one that I like from Danella Meadows, and she was one of the pioneers in systems thinking from MIT. So you can see a definition there. And so when we're talking about systems thinking, we really care about the, as you called out, the interaction between the parts, not the parts themselves, the way that systems affect other systems, patterns and change over time, how feedback is affecting the parts. We look at the purpose of the system. And so we share this because systems thinking is really foundational to the work that Giuseppe and I do. And what we've observed in organizations, when we look at, how does the work really get done, that it operates less like the formal organization chart, and the org chart suggests that organizations are hierarchical, linear, sequential, nice and neatly organized with those nice little boxes and sticks. Everyone knows exactly what they're supposed to do. It's controlled, it's predictable, there's clear and firm boundaries, right? That's what the org chart tells us. But what we see is that the organization operates much more like complex weather patterns, like the tropical rainforest or a coral reef. And those operate as a complex adaptive system, right? They're behaving in ways that are nonlinear, they're networked, they're interconnected, there's diffused control, there's ambiguity, they're emergent, they're adaptable, there's boundaries, but they're permeable, and there's flow, the systems evolve and adapt over time. And so the work that we do, we find that organizations are operating much more like a complex adaptive system, and that calls for a different set of approaches, that we need to work beyond the org structure and pay attention to the systems that we see: emergence, co-evolution, self-organizing, purpose, values, identity, diversity, right? And so there are many ways to look at a system, and we're going to share a few of those, but really looking at seeing the whole, not just the parts, and so that we understand the patterns of behavior over time, because that unveils possibilities of different intervention points. And so a question I like to ask, you know, very practically speaking, is, you know, is the system producing the results that you want when we do org design, right? We ask that question. And if not, look deeper, look at the whole, look at the connections.
So thank you so much, Julia. So as Julia said, if we ask a question, is your system producing the results that you want? That is a really nice segue into what design actually is. And here we're taking a definition that applies to all design disciplines, from product design to design thinking. So in reality, it's not only about how it looks like and feels like. Design is actually what it works. And particularly when we see the organizations as systems, this is a very important definition, because oftentimes we forget about what the purpose of the organization is. So in terms of systems, the purpose of an organization is what it actually does, how it behaves, not how we believe or how we articulate that we want it to behave. So it's very important that we level set on that definition of design, because it matches with the idea of what's the purpose, which ties the system, the organizational system, together. Now, in the next slide, we have mentioned several times that this is about looking at the parts, you know, normally versus looking at the whole. So what do we mean by that? So the way that we have been taught to think, the analytical thinking, deductively, inductively, or whatnot, we fragment the parts to make sense of what is happening. So we look at one specific part, and here, you know, to represent the system, I'm putting in terms of inputs and outputs, you know, like there's a transformation, there's an emergence that happens there in the middle. So in analytical thinking, we are fragmenting that, and we often ask, how does each part relate to the output, right? How does talent relate to this effect? How does having this compensation does this other thing? Now, when we look at systems, we ask a different question. So in the systems, we are actually looking at the patterns of behaviors and the patterns of boundaries, because systems create their own boundaries, and that's how we actually interconnect. And we're looking at the relationships and the dynamics and what emerges from that. So another very important thing is that systems create a different entity on its own, regardless of the parts or and the actors that are part of that. That's how you may see organizations, for instance, that change leadership, they change people and whatnot, and they have the same pattern of behavior over time, regardless of the actors. So in systems thinking, we are asking, how does the output arise from the dance of the several parts? So notice that in looking at the parts, we're looking at the gap. Where is the problem, right? And that has its place and time. In the second one, we are able to lean into the natural complexity of adaptive systems, particularly large systems like organizations, so that we, instead of trying to find the specific gap of the specific problem, we can sense what is happening and evolving in the organization that we may need to look deeper at. So now, before we go to some examples on how we do that, we have some approaches that we wanted to share. Now, what it's important about the approaches is that the work has been done already for us. For the most part, there are a myriad of approaches. So let's start with thinking that a system thinking. System thinking allows us to deal with complexity. And complexity in organizations can arise in many ways. So for instance, here, the viable systems model, it allows us to leverage cybernetics, which it's basically the science of how communication and control happens in computerized systems, and it has been translated to organizational systems, so that the system can thrive in unpredictable circumstances and can be viable long-term. So this one is very much about organization. Then we have something like the Vanguard method, and the Vanguard method comes from the Toyota production system philosophy. So it is more related to how, and it's created basically for service organizations, and it's more related to how is the value being delivered by the system, and how which part of the system are dedicated to honestly kind of doing the failure demand instead of eliminating the failure so that we have less waste or muda. So the Vanguard method is very useful when you are looking at process complexity. And then we have another one that is system dynamics. And in that one, we are understanding the complex interrelationships of systems over time in terms of feedback that the system produces and balancing loops or loops that move another way. So in this one where we can actually, this mathematically can allow us to even forecast movement of systems, it allows us to understand very complex, particularly political situations. So we have different tools, and there's far more of these approaches. But today, Julia and I are going to use particularly the viable systems model and the system dynamics to illustrate how we have used those. But know that in your practice, you may need to use to determine what you're going to use and to what end. So in the first case, this is our first case study. This was the case. So if you please give click, Julia is driving for me. So thank you so much for doing this. So first we start with the diagnosis as every person that is in org design, of course. So we are trying to understand the system. This diagnosis is about understanding the system. So in this case, I'm going to give you 1 minute to, well, 30 seconds to read briefly over the case. And if you notice in this case, basically what is happening is that there is a parent entity that has decided that one part of its offerings does not suit necessarily the core, that it still helps with providing market access and whatnot, but it needs to become independent, so to speak. So it's almost like, if I may say, it's almost like when you have a child that has graduated from college and has not yet launched. And this is interesting about systems. Systems behave similarly, whether organizations or families, any open system behave similarly, but the solution may be different. So just imagine this is your child that has not, that has failed to launch, but you need your child to launch. And that's basically what the problem is. But yet your child has to use resources that you as a parent are providing, like in this case that we are giving. And then they have to learn how to use those resources and influence those resources, although they don't have full authority and determination over that. This is our case study. So if we applied the analytical thinking that we mentioned in terms of breaking down the parts, normally our thinking will go somehow like this. You will say, what's the strategy? What's the gap between what the strategy wants or what the pursuit is and where we are now? You will have a series of sessions and come with a series of hypotheses to solve that gap. And then based on that, you will come to some structural choices. Now, if we apply systems thinking, our questions are different. We start saying like, what is really happening? What is the work system? The work system is that joint effort of human beings to produce something that is bigger than themselves. So what is the work system we are examining? How is it embedded with the other system? One of the important things of systems is that you look at different levels of recursion. So how the system systems are fractal, so they repeat behaviors in different levels of the system. So that's very important to do. We asked the basic question, which is the purpose question: what does this system actually do? Not what people believe it does, but what does it actually do? Then we ask questions like, how do the agents of the system describe the system? Because oftentimes there may be at odds your sense of identity with what this system is. So that's a way of understanding how people see the boundaries. What are stable patterns of interaction that are common and behavior that arises among the agents that are stable over time because you want to see the system. Then we also ask, what are the boundaries? If you could click, thank you, Julia. What are the boundaries within the system? And then how the confined behaviors confine the system? And again, all these questions of connectivity. Now, it's not that the first one is wrong. As a matter of fact, in this particular case, they had done analytical thinking, and the analytical thinking led to the product value proposition and some go-to-market initiatives, but it really didn't help them design. While the systems thinking allowed them to see, and literally they drew the operating model, how they were actually operating, and the interplay between the different areas so they could make different choices. If we look at the example of our child who has graduated from college and has not yet launched, then the question is, what type of questions should I be asking if I want my child to independently go in search for something? Should I go to the analytical thinking and break down the parts and the problems of my child? Or should I lean into who my child is and where my child is at so that I can help them propel differently? This is why we use these two different approaches. Now, in the next one, please, thank you. Now we're going to go to the viable systems model. And I am hoping that I will honor Stafford Beer, who worked in this model, which I find remarkable. So we use this model in particular for the design criterion and for strategic grouping. So when we were defining the design criteria, what the group came up with were these certain elements. This particular group had a vast geography, so they wanted to have autonomy and agility in customer-facing functions, but they wanted to have cohesion and acting as one unit. They wanted to shift from activity-led. Before, they were just doing what they do. They offer that as a value, and now they wanted to be customer-led, meaning that the value was what the customer would value. They wanted to cross-pollinate and bring together different product lines that were represented in different teams. And they wanted to have one central P&L. That was a big change, instead of several P&L centers. And they wanted to simplify decision-making. So the reason why I chose the viable systems model is because the viable systems model sees the system as a unit that for the most part is self-governed. Except with some exceptions. So I'm going to try to explain here the viable system model, and the author already has helped us with trying to compare it with the human body, right? So again, metaphors, but to me at least they work when I was starting my career in our design. So just imagine that you are running a marathon. Everybody here is running a marathon. What happens in a marathon is that your primary activities that deliver value, your legs that are running, your heart that is pumping the blood, right? All of those are, just hold on 1 second. Someone is, my apologies. I needed to put my teams to clear it. So in your marathon, those activities that automatically allow you to run the marathon, those are called like the system one. That's the core of your system. That's what gives it life, so to speak. It's the feed and breed activities. Now, there's also a really wonderful coordination of your system harmonization, which is called the system two. And when we say sympathetic, is that this occurs automatically. Your body goes there. So for instance, your digestive system knows that the blood is being delivered to the legs. So the digestive system says, I am not going to work as hard right now because the person cannot process food, right? So that's the sympathetic system. Now, let's imagine that at some point during your race, you start feeling tremendous cramps. You are in mile 13 and you start feeling tremendous cramps. Your body has never learned that before, right? So there's a subsystem that we call the subsystem three, which helps you self-regulate, learn, provide synergies. That's part of the roles that a system, that you should have in a system. In this case, let's imagine that you have never done this, so you are clueless as to what it happens. So at that point, the system three engages what we call the system four, and the system four is the one that allows us to get input from the senses and the environment and plan and adapt. So your system four sees that there is a water somewhere and that there's a EMT. So you go to the EMT and automatically the race stops being the important thing and your system starts triggering allergogenic. That's how we call it. So signals of pain and whatnot that says, hey, you need to stop this. But notice that this is only exceptional, right? Like it's not the common. You want your system to operate commonly with the sympathetic system, not that parasympathetic stress response, right? So let's imagine that after you EMT, they help you and whatnot, your cortex, which is the system five, which have that they help you with their identity, ethos, connect with the broader system. Your brain reminds you that you're running this race because you want to show your child that you can commit to something and do it. So then with your brain, you know, you commit to this again and start running again, and your sympathetic system and your operating core that starts from three to one starts operating again. Now let's imagine that at 22, mile 22, you start feeling the crampings again. At this point, your system three must know what they need to do. So they go and grab water so that next time you don't have like this shock to the system. This is basically how the Bible system model works. And one of the most important things, and this is why we use it to do the strategic grouping. We basically determine what of these functions are where in the organization, and we use something that is called the Fogg theorem because it appeared at the same time, but no one knows, you know, who the author is, but several researchers came with that, which is the most fundamental design principle. And if we live here and you live with nothing else than this, please, your influence must match the interdependence. So the realm of influence, it has to match that accountability and that connection with the immediate system. This is how we define the design criteria and strategic grouping. And after that, of course, we had to come from macro to micro because you have the big grouping, but then how do you become, how do those become teams, and how does that become jobs, you know, specific capabilities, and how do you distribute that? So one of the things that we did in this case is that we used, because the teams were so distributed and they had to operate through a different entity, but they were very close together, we tried to understand how those teams actually work together and how they create their own behavior, because we had some that were extremely, extremely successful. And we wanted to replicate that. So we use organizational network analysis to understand how were the teams connected and who were the glue. So sometimes, like for instance, in the case to the left, you have the sales manager has a level of influence and a level of impact, but notice how the operations supervisor, which was in another organization, had far more ability to connect people. So what we create was like a function called the team of teams. This is something that comes from the military actually, but this is a way, and that you know, of course, it require a different change methodology altogether, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But what this allowed us is to lean into what was naturally happening in the system so that the communication flows will be maximized, so that people can do their job regardless of the hierarchy. So we were allowing that sympathetic system, that level two to three, to operate autonomously and do their thing, right, by doing this. The other thing that we did is that we identified the influencers, not necessarily among those little teams, but the actual influencers throughout the network, so that we could leverage them as our change agents. And when we say change, you know, normally the organization will, most organizations will do a communication that is top down, that goes across. In this case, we created a series of boot camps to help these, or to ask them to help us understand what was the need of the organization. So it was more them asking from the leadership what they need than us pushing through. And that is a very important thing about the viable systems model, is that it completely turns around the idea of leadership. So normally people serve their leaders. In the viable systems model, the leaders, the brain, the system three, right? All that we said, the eyes and whatnot, are at the service of your core. So it shifts that. And with that, we were able to obtain greater results, and particularly because by applying, in this case, it was organizational network analysis, which is, it's different than that, but we were able to reach a vast majority of the population. What we know is that, or what research tells us, is that by using methods like this one, if you tap into the right 3% of your population, you will have an 85% outreach. And it's not only about information. These agents serve as behavioral transmitters. So that it creates like that viral effect. This is what we did in this particular case. And what we learned from that particular case is that moving systems is like moving an iceberg. So people often think, well, icebergs move by winds, you know, so we change the reporting structure, we change the processes, we change the compensation systems. But what we learn is that in reality, icebergs are moved by the currents, which are more like the patterns of communication, patterns of behaviors, systems dynamics, information and knowledge flows, which precede actually the processes. So, you know, the way that we put it is like, if you are going to propel transformation, do not settle and be the wind. Be brave and bold and be the current. I'm handing it over to Julia now.
Okay, so let's keep that iceberg in mind. And we have a quick poll that will come up. And the question is, how often does your client or your organization have a clear and thorough understanding of the real issues at play? So that's stuff going on below the waterline. So if you could take a few seconds and just respond. Their understanding of the real issues. And let's see how that plays out.
All right, we've got folks answering, so I'll give it another few seconds, but we do have a clear winner.
Okay, that's very curious, because often there's a presenting problem or problems, but also much deeper systemic issues if we look closely enough.
Are we ready?
Yeah. Ah, friends, we have work to do, less than 50% of the time. That was my hunch, and that matches my experience as well. And oh, 6% with the never, we're going to be employed for a long time, guys. So thank you for that. So it sounds like this iceberg is probably relevant for you as well. So we'll just take this a little bit further. And so, you know, as we know, often clients will talk about the surface issues, but we know how icebergs work. There's more that meets the eye. And so in systems thinking, we can use this as a diagnostic tool. right? So at the surface, there's the observable events. We ask what's happening, what do we observe? The things that Giuselli mentioned, what's the reporting structure look like, the job descriptions. And then just below the waterline, there's the recurring patterns of behavior. What are the trends? What's happening over time? And even deeper yet is the structure of the system, right? What's influenced those patterns over time? What are the relationships of the parts? How are they organized? Why is this happening? And then even deeper is the mental models. What assumptions, beliefs, or values do people hold about the system? And in what ways have these mental models created or sustained the structures that are in place? So systems thinking helps us understand the dynamics more deeply than organization charts or governance or process or leaders' assumptions. And so that came into play for sure in a quick case study I'd like to share with you. This one is a small, successful company. They're facing an inflection point, lots of growth potential for them. The CEO knows he needs to take a look at the entire company operating model if he wants to further scale the business. He currently has 15 direct reports. So you are all org designers. You can decide for yourself whether you think that's a good idea and whether or not that's sustainable. And as it turns out, the org diagnosis reveals underlying system dynamics that org structure alone cannot solve. And so let me show you what that looks like. So in systems thinking, we use a lot of tools. Giuselli mentioned a few. One of them that I use a lot are causal loops. And so in this, this data is based on a number of interviews I did with this organization. And the interview data showed that there's not really a unified view or understanding of the company's vision, strategy, performance standards, or line of sight to the goals. And in fact, there are also some personality challenges. And these things lead to tension and conflict. And so it may be easier for the CEO, or maybe it's a preference, that he interacts with his leaders in a hub and spoke, kind of one-on-one style. And that reinforces the tension, right? Or at least it doesn't improve. And so the unintended consequence is that this pattern gets, replicated throughout the organization. It shows up in silos, and that limits cross-functional view and collaboration, which in and of itself reinforces that tension. And so you can see the B and the R, the balancing loop, the reinforcing loop. This dynamic goes round and round and around. And this is a system archetype. So it's a pattern. It's a story we've seen in existence since the beginning of time. And it's called fixes that fail, right? And so if we continue this story and we go another click, when a decision needs to be made, it escalates to the CEO and he makes the decisions. But the unintended consequence of that is that he also becomes a bottleneck, right? And it's probably not sustainable, and there's no capability built to the leaders who need to make the decision on their own next time. And that has the opposite effect of what we want. We want empowered leaders who have the capability and the authority to make at least key decisions, maybe not every decision, but some of the big ones. And this is another system archetype that plays out. It's called shifting the burden. And the real solution is, if I click one more time, the bottom loop there, where when a decision needs to be made, it goes to the leaders and they're able and available and to make those decisions and avoid that whole escalation loop. Okay. So, what we see in this organization is that these behaviors and individual interactions over time have been reinforced through all of these loops going on. And that has also been accepted. It's become a cultural norm. And so these dynamics, if left unaddressed, they erode company performance. And there's a lot of great strengths of this company culturally that it will erode that as well. This is a problem to scaling the business. So in systems thinking, we say, the structure of the system influences the behavior of the people in the system. That structure alone cannot solve this dynamic. And so the action here was to create a unified view of the future and the end-to-end business process. How does this company deliver value to their end customers, to the market? Get really clear on that and make sure everyone can see it and touch it and understand it. And then in addition to organization design, design and operationalize a decision-making framework. And there's work that the CEO and the leaders needed to do to begin changing their own behaviors to drive effective decision-making empowerment. Those things needed to happen for any org structure to work. Take you through another quick one. This one was a large scale global organization. They're doing very well, but the leadership team is also facing many issues. They had turnover issues, process, quality, capability gaps, resource gaps, and this pattern had emerged where they would address each of their issues by kind of these long list of one-off projects, right? If we have a problem with resourcing, let's work on our resource allocation system. If we have a quality problem, let's put a corrective action in place. And so these things weren't wrong, but they were individual solutions for each problem. And so in this case, I conducted an organization diagnosis, collected a lot of data with a traditional survey and O&A, as well as using the systems thinking tool. And that we learned a lot of things from that. And so if I just pull up, you know, one image from kind of the broader set that we learned about this, take a look, you know, at this network here. Anything interesting to you here? And you can feel, go ahead and put it on in the chat. And just imagine, I just call them the blue function, the orange, the green for illustration purposes. But you can imagine that's sales, it's marketing, it's manufacturing. It doesn't matter for our conversation. Those are all different functions. Do you see anything interesting going on in this picture? Yeah, orange function is very broad. Yeah. Orange is everywhere. Okay. What do you notice about the groupings? A lot of overlap between the groups, more concentration. Yeah. And so we learned a lot from the O&A pictures, but in this in one in particular, there's this big cluster of the orange kind of at the bottom right. And then the top left, this big cluster of the blue and then the greens. And where on earth are the pinks and the purples? And you can barely even see them. But these big clusters or communities were suggesting silos in this organization. And while, you know, learning that there's silos, it was no surprise to the leaders of this organization. I'm sure you see them all the time, too. What was really helpful here was that the organization diagnostic with the causal loops and the ONA helped the leaders visualize the silos and elevate the need for cross-functional collaboration as a top org design criteria. Remember, they had hundreds of problems with hundreds of solutions they were trying to go after, but seeing the data help them see that one of our top criteria must be cross-functional collaboration. It also showed that many of the issues were interconnected in ways that they hadn't fully understood before doing this work. And so we're able to reduce the number of the projects using, you know, a data-driven prioritized plan to get this list of 100 projects down to a short list of systemic priorities that would solve multiple issues. And so, you know, a big takeaway here, and this is also a systems principle, is that when you intervene in a system, small interventions can have a huge impact, okay? And if you've heard the saying, can a flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil affect a tornado in Texas? Actually, the answer is yes, according to Dr. Lorenz's research in 1972, which kind of makes my head blow up when I think about that, right? One more really quick one. Is this one was a global, very large multinational global organization. They had a function, a global function that needed to redesign themselves. So they sit in the middle of this very complex company. They was interacting in every market nearly around the world. And they were interacting very hierarchically, the leader was. And they also had some process challenges, talent capability gaps, turnover, succession, like a lot of the things we tend to see. And by doing the systemic org diagnosis, we found lots of blind spots, right? We found that there are different views and expectations from their upstream stakeholders, different views from their downstream ones. There are variants in capabilities required to support their current product portfolio, as well as the products coming down the pipeline that they're going to shift over time. And this one happens to be in a very highly regulated industry. So the regulatory authorities and governments in countries all around the world also have their expectations and policies. So very complex. And so a really big takeaway here, which seems obvious in retrospect, but when you're in it, it's very hard to see the forest through the trees, is that they needed to be able to flex their model to support different modalities and different stakeholder expectations. And so by doing the systemic org design, we help reveal their blind spots and see not only their internal challenges, but also how they fit within the larger system and understand the demands that are placed upon their organization and how they were perceived by the other stakeholder groups, right? it can be really tough to hold up the mirror. There may be people in this organization who saw some of the challenges, but maybe not positioned well. Sometimes people aren't positioned well to raise the issues, or they don't feel psychologically safe to speak truth to power. Enter the power of data, the power of systemic organization diagnosis and org design. So in summary, we're all org designers here in this community. Please do not shortchange a thorough org diagnosis. It's critical. Seek to understand the interconnections of the system, the network as a whole. And I know we love our org design, we love our org structure, but sometimes org structure design is not the best, or the first solution. And also, see the entire iceberg. Diagnosing systemically will reveal those blind spots. It helps you understand the relationships of the parts, the interconnections, and that will result in more effective interventions and org design. And lastly, my favorite, small changes in a complex system can produce large and unexpected effects. And if you want to see a beautiful illustration of that, I've included a video link. We'll share these slides. Thanks, Tanya, for putting that in the chat. That's an awesome 5-minute video. And here's how you can find us. So thank you. Questions, comments?
There's a question, Julia. I don't know if you're reading it. How do you assess the materiality of unhelpful system dynamics?
Yeah, so there's a lot packed into that question. I often find unhelpful system dynamics, and that's why mapping them using the causal loops will help you identify the intervention points, because there are, the way the loops go, there are certain points that give you more leverage than others. So it depends on, what the loop looks like and what system archetype is playing out. You mentioned materiality, and so curious about that. I'm wondering if you mean towards org design, or maybe you need to understand a little bit more about the question there. But I think, overall, every system is going to be a little bit different. But the more we understand about how it's playing out, if we have that data going in on the front end, we're going to do a better org design overall, because we just know so much more.
If I may interject, one of the interesting things about the dynamics of a system, and I think that this is why I like this so much, it's because it's humbling, right? So the way that the system is showing up and how it is behaving, that is the emergence. That's what it's at the core. So when you see it more in terms of the qualification or help of helpful or unhelpful, that is ours. Many systems, to the point of Julia, I mean, all of us have to deal with silos, right? But if you really go and people will say, well, they don't collaborate, people have the problem. We always try to go to the parts because that's how we were taught to think. But for a system to behave like that, there is a reward that the system is getting. There is a positive reinforcement that is occurring in the system for the system to act like that. So probably, one of the things about this is that whatever is unhelpful, then we have to understand how do we qualify and who's qualifying the unhelpfulness. The other thing is this a pattern that exists over time, or is this something that just the client is seeing right now? When you have a new leader, for instance, and there's a research by Gavaro that is interesting about this, people tend to start doing changes when they have not really assessed the system. So it's a pre-evaluation of something. So those are the type of things that we do to understand, is this more of a real pattern? And then what does the pattern say? Why is this pattern holding up over time? What are those underlying structures that are creating and not reporting, but underlying practices, patterns or whatnot that are creating this? So I don't know if that answers the question, but I just wanted to add that.
Great, thank you. There's a question about, curious about where these cases went next and where they are headed now as they view things more systemically. So, I can share, I'll just give one of the examples because I talked through a few. It was pretty eye-opening for the leadership, the CEO in particular, and the leadership team to take the time to, from their the daily grind and pause, and they got them to go off site to really think this through and see the dynamics before they go next. And so it really helped them understand their system differently and be more deliberate about what actions they take forward. And so, you know, are they all systems thinkers? Well, no, not yet. You know, one intervention isn't going to do it, you know, but was it very impactful? Absolutely, because it created the space for them to have a different dialogue than the one that they were having, and one that was deliberate and clearing the path to move forward on how they were going to grow as a company. And so that was the small company that I mentioned with the CEO that was making all the decisions. So just to give one example there.
A similar question is here from Curtis. It's also about the home run success. So again, systems have behaviors over time, and you know, there's no time end where we say, well, this is it, check the box, let's just measure everything and it is done, because the dynamics keep occurring. This is an ongoing, but I would say that the example that I shared, one of the first things where I noticed that things were happening was one of the leaders said to me, I wish I didn't know what I know now, because now I cannot unsee what is really happening. So I was like, oh, okay, that is good. The other one was the leader saying, we are operating differently with each other. We're asking each other different questions. This has been as group therapy. As we leverage the viral change and whatnot, what we are listening from the people is that they believe that they are chartering their own story. Just by engaging them differently, they believe that they are chartering their own story. Now, there's other things happening in the organization that may change that perception right now, but I think that's why we chose that case.
Yeah. Just to further with Curtis's question, I think it was powerful, the one that I shared with the had the O&A involved, because there were just so many light bulb moments, and the leadership team's feedback was actually, wow, wow, wow was the first word that came out of their mouth. And so it helps them understand not just the silos in a different way and the complexity, but there are also implications to onboarding, how they bring their new hires into the company, and time to productivity. If you have a very complex organization that you can now see because you've done a really great diagnosis, that would affect that. Then they could better design how they bring new folks in and support them into coming up to speed. There are implications to succession planning, and through doing this work, we were able to see the influencers, not only to help affect change and drive the changes that they wanted, but also looking at succession planning. We found some roles that were so critical in the organization that they didn't quite realize it until they saw the map lay out, how many interconnections were on a couple of these key individuals. And we don't know from the O&A whether it's the role or the person, but once you're in the system and you get to know them, you can have a hunch, which is it? But it became another layer of like, oh my goodness, that role is so critical. We need to make sure we have a successor in place. And maybe we didn't, because it's not the CEO, it's not the C-suite, that's a couple levels down, but these couple roles were holding the whole network together. So lots of implications there, and that turned out to be very eye-opening. Okay, there's a lot of questions coming in. What suggestions do you all have for service designers seeking to design for systems or organizations to train up and expand our practice? So are you referring to the org design capability? If that was Kevin.
Yeah, thank you. I think referring to, I guess, organization design practice, like I think I've definitely incorporated a lot of the thinking and like living systems theory, starting to incorporate it, but I'm just curious about that transition or any kind of like training models or programs that are appropriate for that particular set of background.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of reading that folks can do, those articles. There are not a lot of training programs out there, at least that I've seen, really from the systemic view. There was a great one that Linkage did years ago. I think Linkage may have been bought by Sherm, don't quote me on that. But there was a great one through Linkage a long time ago that talked about, that really trained people up on how to do systems thinking that they could then apply to whether it's org design, org diagnosis, OD in general, or whatever function they are in the business. I don't know if that's still out there though. I don't know, Giselle, any thoughts around that one?
I honestly, I have learned through practice and a lot of reading and interest. There are a lot of communities out there that propel this thinking. You can find about Donella Meadows online, and there's a systems thinking in systems. It's out there. There is another community that I have to find the name, and I will provide that, and probably we can give you some books, some suggestions for things to read. We will send it through Tanya. Yeah. So
thanks, if that is happy to do that. Yep.
Yes. There's another question about because leaders go to what is tangible again. The reductive thinking, the part thinking, they tend to go to what is tangible, and that has happened to me first. And after I have really unsuccessfully tried to show how the system works and whatnot, what I have found that it's more persuading is that I use another construct that is familiar to them, that has numbers attached, right, kind of lead them to ask different questions. So for instance, if you look at organizational structures, you can use the way that the compensation systems are designed to ask questions that relate to how that doesn't match their criteria or where they're going with that. Or you can do spans and layers, and it's just to point them to that area where they will not have an answer, where they have to make an effort to not find an answer, but where they have to see the behavior. So that's what I have been doing lately. I don't know, Julia, what you have been doing.
Yeah, I think that's great, bringing numbers, right? We know the leaders will pay attention to numbers, and depending on your industry, data as well. There was one example where this client, bringing in the economics, the opportunity cost of the situation, right? They had lots of issues, and they, one of the leaders kind of was bragging about how they had worked with a certain large consulting firm, which I'll not name. It's probably not on this call, but they had spent like $10 million over years working with this consulting firm. And so it was like a simple question of like, wow, then why do the problems still persist? And so getting to them to think about the $10 million investment that they made, and they hadn't made a whole lot of progress for that, it was enough to get them to stop and think about it. So I guess the idea is look for what their hooks are as leaders, find ways to appeal to those hooks, and usually often it's going to be with investments, opportunity cost, data, that sort of thing, to get them to think differently. Okay, what else do we have in here? Oh, when does the book come out? Thanks, Carrie. That comes out in this fall. And so I noticed a couple of the co-authors are on the call here today. So Stop Shift the Energy at Work is coming soon on Amazon. Can't wait to get that out there. We'll be talking about a different set of dynamics, the dynamics of energy in the workplace. So stay tuned for that. And let's see. Looking at what other questions popping up in the chat. Can you share a reading list? Sure. We have lots of favorites. One of my favorites was already mentioned, the Donella Meadows ones. One that's very accessible, of course, you've probably all seen Peter Senge's work. He has done a really nice job at taking very theoretical stuff and making it approachable. And so he's really popularized the concept of systems thinking and a learning organization. So there's that, but there's some of the original thought leaders. The work of Russ Acuff is fantastic out of Penn. And so we can certainly share a list of our sort of favorites, the greatest hits.
Julia, there's a question by Samuel, and it's getting quite a lot of response. Okay. And he's asking about, once the client gets a clarity about the emergent, and he or she goes like, oh shoot, what do I do now? What do I do next now that I have this clarity? So in your experience, this, with clients, how do you respond and what's your offering to them?
Yeah, there is sort of this like, oh no moment when they can really, it's like, it's amazing because they can see now with new eyes, but then it's followed with a, oh my gosh, like now what do I do? So what, now what? And so that's when it's really helpful to understand a little bit more about how the systems, whether if you're looking at systems thinking, how the systems of dynamics work, or if you're looking at networks, how network theory works, because there are certain intervention points. You're going to have 100 ideas that come out of these diagnostics for sure, but knowing where you're going to have the greatest leverage, that comes out of the science as well. And so understanding where those points are and sort of directing your leader's attention to those, here's two or three areas that aren't going to solve everything, but they're going to have a tremendous impact. Let's start here. And in fact, let's start with this one that's going to take you far, right? Back to that principle about the small thing that's going to have a huge impact. And that could be a quick win. It could be a, not so quick, but huge win, but that small thing that's going to make a huge impact. So the theory itself will kind of direct you into that shorter list of things you should go after.
Thanks, Julia.
Okay. Other questions coming up? Systems thinking playbook. Yeah. Did we do this one, Abigail?
Yeah, I did
You
answer
did
that.
one. You did that
That
one. Okay.
probably one of the best things that you can do is to and Julia's really good at that. It will take you a couple of tries, probably you need to reach to her to help you, but it's helping the leaders draw their causal loops, right? Because they're beginning with an assumption. They're beginning with a conclusion, right? What I need to solve this problem is this. So if you start with that and you start saying, so what would happen if this does this and whatnot? And then you ask the other question, and what would happen if this, whatnot? And then you will see how it takes you to a different place. And that's when you can see and honestly even assess if your solution actually is also biased. Like we're human beings, right? So we may see a different solution. And again, one of the good things here, and I think that Julia mentioned to this, is that you don't have to make a big, it's not changed by tsunami, because that's destructive. It's changed by butterfly wings. So it is about understanding in which part of those of that system and that movement and whatnot can you intervene that you will generate far more movement towards where you want to go. So that
Yeah.
was a suggestion.
Yeah. Give it a try. The causal loops are very powerful. The biggest advice I give there is don't causal loop alone. It is much better, with a partner or, if you have a project team, engage the project team. This is a roll up your sleeves. It's whiteboard, it's post-its, it's, identify what are the variables at play, one idea on a post-it, and then start drawing the connections. How do these things connect? And you never get it right the first time or the second or third. It takes some playing around with it to figure out how does this actually work. But it can be wildly powerful as a part of the diagnostic before you do your org design.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, and Giuseppe, for an
Thank you.
amazing, amazing session, for a brilliant session. And thank you to all our listeners for all your questions as well as participation. And we'll be soon coming back with another session for you. And I think this is a topic that we'd love to have again, maybe probe a bit more deeper into these cases. So Julia and Giuseppe, we would love to see you again and host you again.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
And
Thanks,
I want
everyone,
to
so
thank
much.
all of you for being here. Great feedback. You obviously touched a lot of the folks who were able to join today. So we really appreciate your energy. Again, this is all done by just people who volunteer their time for the community. We partner with the European ODF, and it looks like Jim Dowling, who's on the call today, is doing a session for them coming up next week on transforming enterprises. Problem-solving sessions. So if you want some information on that, reach out to me or Jim, or you can look at the European ODF's website. other words, I'm going to wish everyone who's still on the call a great rest of your day. And I'll send out an email when we've got the recordings uploaded, and we'll work with Giuseppe and Julie on an organized kind of resource list that we can share as part of that communication with everyone. So thank you. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, everyone.